So last week, you know, kind of talking about the salvation equation and looking at what it means to be saved. And we're having like kind of, you know, it's not necessarily a theological discussion, and really it's just, you know, what more is necessary in order to be saved. And looking at this narrative in Acts 15 about this discussion amongst what's, you know, known as the Jerusalem Council. They didn't title themselves like "We are the Jerusalem Council," but it was in Jerusalem. It was the church there, and they kind of just talked about, do the Gentiles need to start doing things that the Jews did, you know, adopting customs from the Old Testament law in order to be saved? And so, you know, that's kind of where we have spent our time. And so now we're going to turn to the results of that. And, you know, now that they've kind of made a decision, where do they go from there? And so when we talked last, we, you know, described what the determination was of the council. And essentially it was, hey, here are certain practices that we would recommend for the Gentiles to not do for the sake of Jews who live in the cities where the Gentiles are, so that they wouldn't be an offense to those Jews. And so, you know, kind of stepping back, thinking, you know, what does this all look like? I mean, really, you look at this and say, well, how do I love my neighbor? And what are some ways that, you know, like Paul would say, to be all things to all men, you know, what does that look like and how does that play out? And we have to kind of ask ourselves that question, you know, and this question won't be answered this morning, and we'll see this in other places as we continue on. I mean, letters were written because, you know, Jesus is like, just love your neighbor, right? It's easy. And then, you know, we were like, well, what does that look like? What does that look like to love your neighbor? I do want to kind of ask one question: what you think the role of trust is within this idea of loving your neighbor? Seems like kind of an odd thing, but do you need I'll just leave it at that. Where do you think the idea of trust plays into loving your neighbor? You guys are smart people, so I'll let you take this however you want.
There's a
okay.
Without trust, you've got nowhere.
Okay.
So I would say it's hard to have a loving relationship to your neighbor if you don't have some level of trust. I'm not sure if that's what you meant.
I said take it wherever you want. So,
I took it.
So trust is foundational for a relationship. Why is that? Do you guys buy what Troy is selling?
Trust.
What's that? Trust is hard gained and easily lost. Okay. And so when we think about, you know, this idea of loving your neighbor, you know, Jesus, remember, had to kind of define who your neighbor is. So what's ways that we define who our neighbor is? Let's say in the context of a church, you know, who are different people that are our neighbors? What's that? People around you. Okay. Now they fall in different categories, right? You know, so as broadly as like whoever you come in contact with, right, is your neighbor. So what kind of categories does that fall into? So for instance, you know, I go to church and I follow Jesus. So one category of neighbor could be what?
Body of Christ.
Okay. Other believers, right? And so you think like, okay, well, how do I love those that are other believers, right, in the body, and what does that look like? And again, like I said, we're not gonna go too far into that because we can do this later on, and we will do this later on. But you know, what is loving your neighbor within the context of the church look like?
I think it's just bearing burden.
Okay.
Specifically, what we're called to serve each other.
Okay. Okay.
Some people say the one another is of Scripture.
Okay. And now you think in the context of like those that are outside the church, right? Those that are unbelievers, does that love look a little different? Okay. It will in different ways, right? You know, stirring them up in the faith is not going to happen. Similar goal, yeah. Correct.
I think our goal is the same.
Correct.
I show grace and mercy to bear burdens and even stir them to love, even though they don't know that love. But we gain access through that same objective.
Yeah.
We just might be rejected, but hopefully we are in the church.
Right.
Take that step further and go back to your question about trust.
Yeah.
There's a degree to which what Troy is saying is that.
Mm-hmm.
Even those people we were just talking about, they may reject us, they may hate us, they may persecute us, they may kill us, we're still called to love them.
Yeah. Yeah. And when what does that trust look like? You know, for within the church, I think trust is assumed. Assuming because of our relationship with Christ, that if somebody has that same relationship with Christ, then we have kind of this built-in assumption that because you follow Christ and I follow Christ, then I can speak into your life and I can say certain things. Now, I mean, we should do, you know, we didn't do it with love and patience and gentleness and all of those things. For an unbeliever, it might be more of a one-way, right? But in the same vein, we want them to trust us because essentially we want them to trust Christ. And so how we build that up and how what that looks like is something important. So when we kind of talk about, you know, the things that that were said is, you know, to be loving to others so that others will be open to the gospel. And if you do certain things, you might break that assumption that, you know, you might violate what somebody believes is loving and therefore close the door to the gospel. And so let's kind of see how that is taken for what the Jerusalem Council said that they were going to do. So we're in verse 22 of Acts chapter 15. And this idea of trust will be built into this with, you know, the end of chapter 15. So kind of hold that in the back of your mind. But verse 22 in chapter 15, we read, "Then it seemed good to the apostles and the elders and the whole church to choose men from among them and send them to Antioch with Paul and Barnabas. And they sent Judas, called Barsabbas, and Silas, leading men among the brothers, with the following letter. The brothers, both the apostles and the elders, to the brothers who are of the Gentiles in Antioch and Syria and Cilicia, greetings. Since we have heard that some persons have gone out from us and troubled you with words, unsettling your minds, although we gave them no instruction, it has seemed good to us, having come to one accord, to choose men and send them to you with our beloved Barnabas and Paul, men who have risked their lives for the name of our Lord Jesus Christ. We have therefore sent Judas and Silas, who themselves will tell you the same things by the word of mouth. For it has seemed good to the Holy Spirit and to us to lay on you no greater burden than these requirements, that you abstain from what has been sacrificed to idols, and from blood, and from what has been strangled, and from sexual immorality. If you keep yourselves from these, you will do well. Farewell." So what was ultimately the response to the decision made by at the Jerusalem Council? What do they say? Like, you know, what are we going to do as a result of this determination of what we think the Gentiles should do?
Send them a letter.
Okay. Send them a letter. And not just that, what else are they doing? Okay. They said sending some leading men from there. Okay. And they're really, you know, having these two guys go with Barnabas and Paul. So why not just tell them, you know, why not just trust, okay, hey, Barnabas and Paul, we've kind of hashed this out. You just go back to Antioch and tell them what we've determined. So why do you think go, you know, send the letter and send these other two guys with them? Okay. So it could be, you know, that Especially since the determination was kind of where Barnabas and Paul, you know, what they were arguing for. Okay, what else? Okay, there could be safety in numbers. Okay. Okay. A man, good management team. You're gonna write a book about this. And I don't know the team that came down, right? You know, because Barnabas and Paul made their way down, and I don't know who else they came with. But okay, so you might have some safety. What else do you think is going on there? So, you know, one is to make sure that they know, but what else? Kind of what do they make the, you know, what do they pretty much admit to, you know, to those that are in Antioch about people that came from Jerusalem earlier? What's that? They troubled them. Yeah. Yeah. So it was almost like, you know, people came from Jerusalem. What did you say?
That's a big news.
Yeah. So, you know, the people came from us and came up and, you know, troubled you guys and disturbed you guys and you know, kind of unsettled things up there. So we're going to send a delegation, you know, at least these two men to go with them, plus the letter from the elders and the apostles to kind of make things right. And so we see that these two men are prophets, Silas, is, somebody that will accompany, we'll actually see him a little bit later, will accompany, Paul, on his missionary journeys. Judas was Barsabbas, which means Sabbath born. So he might be of Jewish lineage. Silas, is short for Silvanus, which is a Greek name. So you've got kind of maybe this two people that have a delegation that are, you know, both Jewish and Gentile in makeup that are coming and being sent from this group again to tell them and to let them know, like, we stand by your side. And so, who do they address with the letter? I'll just kind of go over that real quickly. You know, one, it says to the church in Antioch. That was the specific church that was having the issue, right, that Paul and Barnabas were at. Barnabas went and grabbed Paul from Tarsus and brought him to Antioch, and they ministered there. And so it was there, that church, that they address it to. It also addresses to Syria. Antioch is in the area of Syria. It's now in Turkey, but it borders on Lebanon. And so it's kind of the area close by, and then Cilicia is in Turkey, but it's the area where Tarsus was. So it's almost like, you know, Antioch, and then even further north from Antioch to some of these churches, even to where Paul was from, that they had kind of addressed. Not only, we know we unsettled things in Antioch, but we want to make sure that others in that region are understand kind of, you know, what we've talked about. And so what is the content of the letter? Like, what are the things that they do in the letter? It's a really short letter. It's like, I mean, is it a letter? I don't know. It's more like a,
they distance themselves.
I mean, yeah.
They distance themselves from false teachers.
Okay. So they distance themselves from the false teachers, right? A little bit. But they even kind of, you know, seem to, you know, but they also address it, right? So they want to clear up that kind of confusion. Like, you know, hey, that's, you know, we understand that that's what happened, and this is why, how we're going to try to make it right. And then so they're trying to clear up kind of like that unsettledness, and then they address the issue. What was the issue that they are trying to address? Remember, what was the argument? Yeah, and the way they put it is, you know, should you be burdened by these things? So to answer the question, should you be burdened by the Old Testament regulations as a Gentile? And what was the answer to that? No. So they kind of clear that up, that no, like the things that the people were arguing about, we've kind of settled that no, you shouldn't be burdened by these things. And they came up with kind of some solutions, though, that no, you're not going to be burdened by these things, but yes, here's some things that we want you to kind of keep in mind, some things that you can avoid that will cause divisions among you. We talked about that last week, some of those specific regulations and why those things were mentioned. And then really that's kind of short and simple, right? I feel like maybe it's almost a little too short and simple, but there didn't need to be, you know, much about it. You know, they said that Paul and Barnabas and these other two men can then answer any other questions that you have and clear things up. So, you know, what do you see from this that indicates that the apostles and elders did their best to support the Gentile believers? As you kind of like step back and think, you know, what shows that, you know, these men in Jerusalem are trying to like make amends? Okay, perfect, perfect. Yeah, it wasn't just like, hey, we decided to, you know, here's some things that you guys should be doing, you know, just so you don't mess them up. But it's like, yes, we recognize that, you know, there's some things that caused you distress. As fellow believers, as Gentiles, you may be Gentiles, but you're not lesser than in our eyes. And so they recognize that. And then they do some things where, right, they not only, again, sent, you know, Paul and Barnabas back and commend them kind of in this letter, but then they sent a letter, you know, specifically from them, like, we're not all coming up here, but from us, we are on your side and on your behalf. And then we're sending two men who are also known as prophets, right, as a demonstration that we're here for you. And then even that, and then also distancing themselves a little bit from those that caused the trouble. And again, this won't be the last time that these types of individuals will cause trouble within the church, because we know Paul will write letters, and in those letters at different times after the Jerusalem Council, he's going to address similar situations. And we'll see that kind of pop up. But here they're trying to, again, make amends with them. Now, one of the questions that kind of comes up is, you know, does Paul, like later on in his ministry, you know, violate any of these things? You remember, so later on, he's going to write a letter to the Corinthians, and he'll even mention it in Romans, where he says, he talks about meat being sacrificed to idols. So not kind of taking us too much on a tangent, but what was his determination when it came to those things? We'll look at this a little bit in detail later on, because it's important and it comes up in a couple letters. But what was the determination that was made about meat sacrificed to idols? Okay. Right. So did Paul have any issues eating meat sacrificed to idols? Yeah. What's that? Yeah. I guess that's a great way to put it. By himself, you know, behind closed doors, did he have any issues?
Yeah, I've kind of looked at it like, you know, if I go down to Publix and the filet's $26.99 a pound, because it hadn't been sacrificed to an idol, and it's $6.99 a pound because it has, I'm getting the $6.99 filet because I don't believe in idols.
Unless you know that, you know, I see you in the grocery store and I have an issue, yeah, right, then you might be like, yeah, yeah. You'll circle back around. And so, yeah. Just hide behind the aisle. Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, so it's kind of one of those things, right? You know, so, you know, that's kind of some of the things that you think about. And I want at least to say, like, no, he doesn't violate these things. These are things that are, hey, we want you guys to not do, particularly when it came into public. And they could have gone much more in detail, because Paul goes in greater detail. Obviously, this letter doesn't clear up everything for all of these people. And even Paul's letter, as he goes further in detail about certain items, like there, we know even with the Corinthians, like he wrote four letters, right? And then they wrote letters back. And then we see how he responds, like, hey, you know, because of this previous letter, this is something I need to clear up. So those things happen, particularly as communication is just done via letter. So hopefully, at least in Antioch, these things have been kind of put to rest. But as soon as like everybody goes their own separate ways and you encounter a situation a year or two later, you're like, I don't know. Is that, that's kind of maybe a gray area. I'm not sure. Like, we didn't address that specifically. I know we don't need to get circumcised, but what about this other thing? And so that's kind of where we're always like trying to like go back to scripture and say, well, what's the intent? What does God want us to do? So on the surface, are these things easy to obey? The things that like the Gentiles were told. Okay. On the surface, yeah, right, they're easy to understand, right? But sometimes it's hard to do. We even know that, and we'll go there real quickly, is if you go to Galatians 2. We mentioned it last time, but I want to mention this because it'll feed into what we're going to talk about in just a minute. But Galatians, this letter to the Galatians was written after the Jerusalem Council. And it's not understood how much later after the Jerusalem Council. It could be shortly after, or it could be after Paul's next missionary journey. So it could be, you know, within a couple years from that. So Galatians chapter 2, verse 11. But when Cephas came to Antioch, and that's Peter, I opposed him to his face because he stood condemned. For before certain men came from James, he was eating with the Gentiles, but when they came, he drew back and separated himself, fearing the circumcision party. And the rest of the Jews acted hypocritically along with him, so that even Barnabas was led astray by their hypocrisy. But when I saw that their conduct was not in step with the truth of the gospel, I said to Cephas before them all, if you, though a Jew, live like a Gentile and not like a Jew, how can you force the Gentiles to live like Jews? And then, you know, he'll go on and say, we ourselves are Jews by birth and not Gentile sinners. And he'll actually kind of talk about the things that we've talked about when it comes to, you know, where does being a Jew kind of line up within how you live? But we even see that Peter, right, who is the one who stood up at the Jerusalem Council and made, you know, his own testimony about going to the centurion, like he himself fell under the pressure of, you know, like who is my neighbor, right? You have people visiting who feel strongly about their dietary laws, like Peter got sucked in and kind of, you know, went and ate with them. You know, you could say, well, I was just being hospitable, right? And I was, you probably, you know, in his mind, he's not thinking I'm putting down the Gentiles or doing a disservice to the Gentiles. But Paul calls him out and says, no, this is exactly what you were doing. And so felt like he had to do that, probably because he saw how the Gentiles reacted, and Peter may not have even been aware of that. And so we see some of these issues pop up. You even see at the end of Acts, you know, in Acts chapter 21, when Paul later comes to Jerusalem, the elders tell him, we want you to help, you know, take these men and pay for them to fulfill their vow, which was something under the Jewish law. And so you sometimes see like, well, when was it a good thing to do and when was it not? And that whole point of that was people started to believe that Paul was saying, if you are a Jew and you follow the Old Testament law, then actually he's telling, the understanding was that Paul was telling people, you no longer should be following the Old Testament law or customs. And they wanted to say, well, you know, he's not necessarily saying that, you just don't have to. And again, obviously this issue is bigger than just what would have been handled within the letter. But we'll keep to the context here. So I'm just kind of throwing out that, you know, all of this has not been cleared up. And we will go to some of those passages when we talk about, well, where does conscience fit in and where does loving your neighbor fit in and how does that play out as described in some of these other letters in detail. But how do they respond? So we see in verse 30, so when they were sent off, they went down to Antioch, and having gathered the congregation together, they delivered the letter. And when they had read it, they rejoiced because of its encouragement. And Judas and Silas, who were themselves prophets, encouraged and strengthened the brothers with many words. And after they had spent some time, they were sent off in peace by the brothers to those who had sent them. But Paul and Barnabas remained in Antioch, teaching and preaching the word of the Lord with many others also. So what was the response from the church and how the Jerusalem council responded? What was the church in Antioch's response? Positive. Yeah, it says they were encouraged, right? And so they were encouraged by these steps. And why do you think they reacted that way? What's that? They like bacon. Yeah. So that's, yeah. They were exhorted and strengthened. Yeah. Yeah. And distance is what causes, strain on a relationship. And it could be even like, we're in a room together all the time, but if I never talk to you, then there might be certain assumptions that come in my mind about how things are, right? So especially, churches that are separated by distance, you just have certain assumptions about certain groups. And even they may be thinking, as Paul and Barnabas are away, there's still probably things that are churning while those guys are gone. And who knows, there's probably voices of the Judaizers that are still there, of the circumcision party that were still there, trying to do things. And so they're encouraged, by what was said. It could have said, hey, we do feel like these burdens should be placed upon you. So one, the burdens are removed, and that is just an encouragement. But like Hay said, you've got two men who are from this church that were willing to stay with them and encourage them and exhort them with other words that, again, strengthen that bond between those two churches. And so, now how would Antioch be viewed in terms of the church in Jerusalem? It's probably now kind of a close connection, not just like, oh yeah, Barnabas used to be down in Jerusalem, now he's up there, and just some close contacts. But now you've got this connection between those churches. So it probably bears to be said is that even though Antioch was a strong church, and we haven't, we didn't go through a whole all the things about in Acts, but if you kind of know about the church in Antioch, what would make you assume that Antioch was a strong church? And I guess there's different ways you can define this, but what?
They resisted the false teaching, and they were rejoicing in the truth that was confirmed, so they didn't seem to be very vulnerable to.
Okay.
Definitely troubled. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and definitely here in that context, that's what you see. But a little bit even before then, the church has elders themselves. And those elders, remember when Barnabas and Paul were first sent out, right? They were a church that prayed together. They fasted. They really, not only that, Paul and Barnabas have been there teaching and exhorting them for years. And then those guys were sent out from the church as missionaries. And so you see this strong relationship that Paul and Barnabas are going to continue to keep coming back to Antioch. They will go to Jerusalem and just kind of report things, but their home church is that church in Antioch. So at least, plus it's in a large city. Again, remember we said it's the third largest city in the Roman Empire. And so from these things, we would say all that has all the makings of a strong church, especially when they're at the point where they're sending out, missionaries and supporting them, that this is something that that indicates, again, that they're not a fledgling church, that they have some things that some structure to it. But even though that church was a strong church, they themselves still needed to be encouraged, right? Because every church, no matter what church you're in, is subject to strain in relationships, subject to division within this body. And so something that can never go unlooked, is that issue of making sure that the church and the body is taken care of. And so so I kind of wanted to kind of think about that as then we get to this last section in Acts and how we kind of understand these things that go on. So verse 36, and after some days, right, some days of Paul and Barnabas being there teaching and preaching, Paul said to Barnabas, let us return and visit to the brothers in every city where we proclaim the word of the Lord and see how they are. Now Barnabas wanted to take with him John, called Mark, but Paul thought best not to take with them one who had withdrawn from them in Pamphylia and had not gone with them to the work. And there arose a sharp disagreement, so that they separated from each other. Barnabas took Mark with him and sailed away to Cyprus, but Paul chose Silas and departed, having been commended by the brothers to the grace of the Lord, and he went through Syria and Cilicia, strengthening the churches. Well, okay, so we see here that Paul and Barnabas were prompted to leave Antioch, and what prompted them to do so? They've been there for a while, they've been teaching and preaching. What's kind of been the burden laid on their hearts? Yeah. And so they had done this first missionary journey, and when they came back to Antioch, that's when they had to go down to Jerusalem, and they stayed in Antioch to make sure everything was fine. But they're like, you know what? We've got all these other churches that you know, are hungry for good teaching and hungry for discipleship, and we need to go check on them to make sure that, you know, we're being fed here. This church is good. Let's go and check on them. So all the makings for Paul and Barnabas to get together and go on their second missionary journey together, but what happens? They had a disagreement. What was the disagreement over? Who was going on the team? If you know who, you know, so they are arguing over a person, which is kind of like, oh man, it's like, how do we argue, you know? Like, I want him to come with us, and the one guy is like, I don't, you know. So that's kind of like a tough position to be in. It says that there was a sharp disagreement. The root word for that is sour wine, right? This continual agitation or provocation. One commentary says that it's a severe fit of a disease or an attack of fever that could be added to that. It's just this like, It's something that is right is a is causing a weakness and a strain between these two people, a heated argument over should we take John, Mark, or not. Hopefully he wasn't in the room with them when they were discussing this. Now John Mark is Barnabas's cousin, and so he had gone with them on their first missionary journey, but turned around after they left Cyprus, turned around when they hit the Asia Minor and went back. The question is like, so what's kind of going on with this issue? You know, why is that a problem? You know, there's kind of a few things that you could think about. You know, Paul, he might think, right, well, what if he does this again, right? We're going to get them out, you know, on our next journey. And then halfway through, he's going to want to turn around and, you know, go back again. It's like, right, nobody ever wants to turn a trip around or have that stop, you know. And so so John Mark might be looked at as like a burden. It's possible that because even the way that it's described is that it almost seems like maybe John Mark didn't earn the right to go back there, right? That he had not gone with them to the work. So that could be the other thing that in Paul's mind is, you know, we don't want you going because you didn't go there before. Could be some, touchy situations. It could be like, you know, they know, Paul might be saying, well, the people know me and Barnabas, and even the people that, right, some of the places that they went to, they were not welcome. And so bringing a third person might have agitated the situation more. We don't know from the context or any of those things, but those all those things are something, you know, in our minds. But really, in the end, and again, it seems from the indication is that Paul thinks that there is some sort of character flaw within John Mark, and he could not trust him to bring him along. Now, Barnabas wants to bring John Mark. And so what do you think maybe some of the reasons are that Barnabas wants to bring John Mark on this trip. We can get nepotism out of the way, right? I'm related to him, you know. I got to look out for him. So, but what could be some other reasons?
Wants to mentor him.
Wants to mentor him. Okay. Now, what happened before, right? On the first missionary journey, did he complete that first missionary journey? No. So he turned around, went home. And so, how do you think John Mark would have felt after that? He might be discouraged, right? He might feel like, you know, I really thought I could do it, and then, you know, now I'm a failure. And so Barnabas, right? Again, remember, we know that Barnabas is the encourager, is that he might be thinking, you know, this is an opportunity to restore this person, to restore him and allow him, you know, another shot in ministry. And so, again, we don't know all the details, but there is, you know, both sides that seem legitimate that we could infer. Again, we don't know exactly what it's like. You know, maybe it's like, again, something silly that Paul thinks John Mark snores and he doesn't want him to come along. But we're going to think the best of both of these. What's that?
But it specifically says why he didn't want
him
to go.
It's
because
that he what?
Because he had deserted him. That's pretty clear.
Well, exactly, exactly. But we don't know the reasons why Barnabas wanted to bring him back again. And we don't know exactly, like, you know, so he did desert him. So what's the issue? Is he going to desert him again? Or he didn't earn the right to finish, you know, before. And so that's why. But he did desert them. That's the facts. It's like, what's Paul, you know, leaning on? But I do think it's probably the big issue of I don't trust that he's going to make it on this. What's that? It's funny how that happens, right? Yeah, so. Just works out that way sometimes. So it comes to that issue. But now it's two brothers, right? Two strong brothers. I mean, and so the question is, well, who's right? Who's right?
I don't think that's fair to say that.
That's what I'm saying.
But doesn't Paul?
But we know that John Mark is all in accordance to God's predetermined will.
It is.
So God's right.
God's right. God's right. That's the wrong question, isn't it? Is who's right? Because don't we do want to say who's right in these situations, right? Especially when it comes to believers having disagreements, right? You know, you find yourself in one camp or another. And then you determine who's right or who's wrong. Like, what's the pros of them sticking together? Like, what would have been beneficial for them to stick together in this situation?
The question you said earlier, you know, the more the merrier. If you have four like-minded men traveling together, it's just a stronger team, more support.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we'll get there, right? In a different way. So you've got the pros would have been if Barnabas said, no, let's leave John Mark and he can stay, we'll stick together, and I'll just say, John Mark, sorry, you'll have to hit us up on the next one. Is that right? They could have gone together back to the same churches. We could have found out a little bit more about Barnabas and all of those things. And so, you know, we've got kind of the missionary journeys. It might have. What's that?
The churches would be familiar with both.
The church would have been familiar with both. It would have ended like the disagreement. One would have submitted to the other and just said, "Okay, let's do this," and then like that kind of put that to bed, right? And so we've got that kind of side to it. But what happens when they split up?
Well, now you got two teams. So you got double
width. So you got two teams, right? And we see that Paul is going to go in one direction, and we're going to see Barnabas go in the other direction. And they're able to cover different ground. Yes, this is the last time we hear about Barnabas in Acts, which is kind of sad because Barnabas played such a strong role in encouraging even Paul. And sometimes, you know, it comes to it. Like one commentary says that Barnabas, because Paul was an apostle, like he was the one who should have really like submitted to Paul in what Paul wanted to do. But on the flip side, I could see where Barnabas was the one who's like, hey, he got Paul and said, hey, come to Antioch. And he's been the one that's like really pulling him in. I mean, Paul might have the greater gifts, but Barnabas is the one who's always there kind of, you know, being there to support Paul. And in the same way, he's like, just like I supported you, Paul, I want to support John Mark. And so maybe Paul should have been the one who submitted. And so sometimes, again, we can see both sides of the story and say, like, well, who was right or who was wrong? And it sometimes for us makes things easier if we just say, like, well, he was right and they were wrong. And that just, like, puts an end to it. But that's not necessarily right how God works, because he obviously had Barnabas, you know, feeling strongly one way and Paul in another. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So,
it does, going back to the issue of trust, we just have to recognize these are both men and we are both men. The only way to really understand how to trust others, how to be trustworthy, is to recognize all fools.
Yeah.
Jeremiah 17:9, this is the hardest, deceitful, wicked, desperate, sick. Who can understand it? And it's not calling us to examine others' hearts, to examine their untrustworthiness. It's calling us to realize, you know, I am untrustworthy apart from the character of Christ. I can't be trusted myself. And then that lays out my perspective and attitude towards others, that I'm not concerning about their character but mine.
Mm-hmm.
And realize that only God can be trusted in all these things. I'm just called to love and all the one another's that Troy was mentioning. Not one that says to trust one another. It's everything else but that, but trust in the Lord with all your heart.
Yeah.
I'm only need to be concerned about, am I trustworthy? And the only way I can be trustworthy is, you know, by the imputed righteousness of Christ and the Holy Spirit dwelling in me and acting the characters of Christ in me, never losing the reality that I'm a fool and I can't be trusted.
Yeah. Because trust can be broken, right? And then trust also can be amended. And so it's how much trust do you put. And so for a time, right, we see the band break up. But they will be reunited. And we can be encouraged by that, right? Because Barnabas is later mentioned in the letter to the Corinthians. So we know that Paul reconnects with Barnabas later on, because he won't get there till his next missionary journey. And so afterwards, you know, again, he connects up with Barnabas. And then even John Mark, right? Even though he goes off with Barnabas, we find that John Mark ends up being connected back with Paul. And so we understand that, you know, Mark is later mentioned in not only a couple of Paul's letters, but also Peter's letters. And so we know that he has, again, been trusted for different ministry opportunities. And so we see that in this moment, right, that there is a separation, but that doesn't mean that it is permanent. And we don't know where Paul comes, you know, what issue, like how that reconnection is. We just know it's there. But at that time, they went about their separate ways. And so in our own lives, because we're sinful, we always face conflict. And so how do we balance that with being united? And again, that's kind of been a big discussion, right? Even all throughout, we've talked about kind of different denominations and kind of different, splits within the churches and things like that. At what point is it okay to go your separate ways? And when is it okay? You know, when should we submit and stay together? And so those are questions that we're going to address, you know, as we go on a little bit later. But what do you guys think as you kind of weigh those things, those two ideas?
Simply trying to they're just simply applying their own wisdom and experience to be faithful to the Lord, and they're coming to two different conclusions.
Mm-hmm.
And so maybe the right course of action, instead of trying to force the other to submit and break their conscience, maybe the right course of action is to maybe separate.
Well, the Bible doesn't tell us, but usually there's other disagreements that have happened prior to a really big blow-up in a relationship, so it's easy to believe that Paul and Barnabas are ideologically moving apart a little bit on their approach, and so this was kind of a last straw. You know, he doesn't tell us that, but
you're talking about in their ministry approach, and it's possible. It's possible. So, and we don't know that either. So it's hard. It's hard to say. There's always a lot that goes into a decision. Even if you see like there's conflict here on the surface, or there's disagreement, is there more kind of down the surface? And so it could be an issue, right? Obviously, if it's an issue of sin, it's you know, you typically we sin is never a reason for division. In fact, that's kind of almost the issue that needs to be addressed. When it comes to an issue that is not a matter of moral choice, but of, you know, preference, that's where we'll kind of start to kind of go a little bit into discussions. And it could just be the way of different approaches of how people want to handle certain situations. Doesn't necessarily mean, yeah, it's right or wrong. I mean, obviously one believes their way is better, and the other way, the other person thinks their way is better. And so sometimes moving in opposite directions. But it doesn't say anywhere that they, you know, even though they were sharply disagreed with one another, and it probably got heated at times, that these men hopefully still separated but loved each other and understood, you know, maybe it's best that we go our separate ways. And that's why later on that they were able to kind of pull back around. But again, we'll kind of talk about this and hit this.
For both of them.
Yeah.
In the sense that Paul sees the need of having someone he can trust on the journey to this in Jericho, whereas Barnabas sees an opportunity to go a different direction and bring him up and mentor him in a different way that doesn't require that trustworthiness.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and there's a lot more that we could say about this and kind of some details and other things, but we'll kind of leave it at that. But I want us to kind of think as we kind of think of our own approaches, and we have these situations that we deal with, you know, the things that we give up out of love for one another, but then sometimes, you know, there are situations where it's understood that we can rightfully kind of move in different directions, but still understand that we are united in our love for one another. Again, more on that because Paul will address this in other letters, and so we'll come back to this idea a little bit later. Any final thoughts or questions?